I'm Karen Given.
It's Michigan! And the Wolverines are the national champions!
What if I told you that the most successful college hockey program in U.S. history owes its existence to a Canadian who grew up hating the United States, to an unsolicited act of kindness from an entire city, and to one of the largest explosions in history?
Incredibly, it is fair to say that.
That's John Bacon, who's researched the founding of the University of Michigan hockey program. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler with the story.
Picture the House chamber at the U.S. Capitol. It's 1911, and the Speaker of the House, a guy named Champ Clark, takes the floor and says,
I look forward to the time when the American flag will fly over every square foot of British North America up to the North Pole.
The Speaker of the House, the Paul Ryan of his day, actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's his whole point.
That's John Bacon again.
He received loud cheers and a great write-up in the Washington Post. So that's how unfriendly we were as late as 1911.
Anyways, north of the border, lots of people were not too fond of the U.S. Joseph Bars, the guy at the center of this story, was 19 years old in 1911, and he had basically been born to hate the United States. It was in his blood. His ancestors had once lived in Massachusetts, but fled to Nova Scotia.
They were loyal to the crown and not to the rebels, the revolutionaries, of course.
When the Revolutionary War started, Bars' great-great-grandfather fought on the British side. But Bars was named after his great-grandfather, who was even more fearsome.
He captures, burns, or sinks more than 60 American ships during the War of 1812, so much so that he becomes the most wanted man in America. And that is our hero's great-grandfather.
Joseph Bars grew up in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. He was just 5'8", but he was strong. He starred on the hockey team at Acadia University. Not long after graduation, he found a personal reason to hate the United States. In 1915, he gave up a comfortable job in Montreal to join the Canadian Army in the trenches of World War I. He was angry that the United States wasn't yet sending troops. Soon he had bigger problems. At the Battle of Mont Sorel in 1916, a German trench mortar nearly killed him. Bars was in a body cast for 6 months, then returned to Wolfville, about an hour from Halifax, to recuperate. The man who'd once been strong enough to do a lap around the rink on unlaced ice skates now struggled to move his left foot.
He comes back and he's kind of a lost soul, essentially. He does not want to go back to Montreal and be a businessman. He does not want to take over his dad's grocery store, which his dad thought he would. So he's lost, looking for a sense of purpose, and he finds it by accident.
In November 1917, Russia dropped out of the war. This meant the Germans could focus on the Western Front, and that made the Allies very nervous. They decided they needed more firepower. A French freighter called the Mont Blanc went to New York to stock up on airplane fuel and explosives. Then it headed north to meet a convoy in Halifax that would then leave for Europe. The Mont Blanc was packed with 6 million pounds of TNT and another explosive called picric acid.
That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty, and they're so nervous about it that they cover their boots with canvas covers to make sure they don't spark on deck. You're not allowed to have matches on your person anywhere near the ship, and in a smoking era, that's a four-day sacrifice these French guys are not used to. So that's how terrified they are of this thing blowing up, and it crawls up the coast to Halifax.
German U-boats had already sunk 3,000 Allied ships, so the Mont Blanc crew was itching to get into Halifax Harbor.
These guys are terrified of getting blown up. Another ship, the Emo, a Norwegian supply ship, it's already a day late and wants to get to New York to load up with various relief supplies. They have no idea what Mont Blanc has got on it. Only like 5 guys in the harbor who aren't on the ship know about this. Emo is in a hurry that morning, and it keeps on passing ships on the left. That is against nautical convention.
Both the Mont Blanc and the Emo reach the narrows of the Halifax Harbor at the same time, heading right at each other.
And Mont Blanc thinks this guy is crazy and has one blast on the horn, which means I'm in the right place, you need to move. And Emo comes back with 2 blasts, saying, screw you, I'm going this way. Finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc realizes this guy's crazy, so it bails to the left, to the middle of the harbor, just as Emo does the same thing.
They collided. It wasn't a big collision, but it was enough to knock over barrels of airplane fuel on the Mont Blanc.
And the stuff ignites, and the crew knows they're about to blow up. So they hop in their rowboats and go the other way away from Halifax, crucially. Instead of warning anybody, they go to the woods of Dartmouth and they run into the woods as far as they can.
The ghost ship, now on fire, continued toward Pier 6 in Halifax Harbor. On land, one of the guys who knew what the Mont Blanc was carrying started hollering that the ship was going to blow and everyone needed to run. A train dispatcher named Vincent Coleman heard the message and started to run for his life.
And then he stops, because he remembers that the number 10 train from New Brunswick is coming in 5 minutes. It's going to park right in front of Pier 6. And if it does, everyone's going to die. So he runs back to the telegram office and starts furiously clacking off these messages to other train stations saying the following. Hold up the train. Ammunition ship afire in harbor, making for Pier 6 and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys. And those are his last words.
At 9:04 in the morning, the Mont Blanc exploded.
This is a miniature atomic bomb. Human beings were flown half a mile in all directions. In that split second, 25,000 people are homeless, half the city is gone, 9,000 are wounded, and 2,000 are dead.
For the next 3.5 hours, all the telegraph lines in Halifax were down. But thanks to that final message from Vincent Coleman, word started to spread. And that's how Joseph Bars and the people in Wolfville got the news.
A doctor friend of his says, you know first aid, you gotta come and help me.
Bars, still walking with a cane, boarded the next train for Halifax and ended up at Camp Hill Hospital. The hospital was packed. There were so many people in need of help that doctors ran out of anesthesia. They kept operating. For the next 14 straight hours, Bars dressed wounds, set fractures, and even helped with surgeries, something he'd never done before. Meanwhile, Vincent Coleman's message had also gotten to Boston. The Massachusetts governor called an emergency meeting and, without waiting to hear back from anyone in Halifax, decided to send a train filled with doctors, nurses, and medical supplies. Meanwhile, Bars kept working in the hospital. After about 3 days, he was finally relieved by the doctors from Boston. One Nova Scotia historian wrote, "Substantial help was on the way from Toronto and Montreal, but the first and most valuable assistance came from that ancient foe beyond the Bay of Fundy."
And that is when the U.S. and Canadian relationship starts to change, and very dramatically. And Bars himself, very anti-American for a lot of reasons, he says, "I will never be able to say enough about the wonderful help the states have sent. The response was so spontaneous and everything done even before it was asked for. It brought tears to all our eyes. You know, we've always been a trifle contemptuous of the United States, but never again. They can have anything I've got, and I don't think I feel any differently from anyone else down here either."
On the train ride back to Wolfville, Bars, the man who'd been so lost, realized what he wanted to do with his life. He would become a doctor. And instead of going to a Canadian university, Bars enrolled at the University of Michigan. There, he started to skate at Michigan's Coliseum. This was the steel and concrete three-walled building that housed the hockey rink. Bars slowly made his way around the ice, trying to regain control of his foot. By 1922, he was healthy enough to referee the club hockey team's games.
And finally, he walks down to the athletic director's office, Fielding Yost, who built the big house in Ann Arbor, one of the most legendary coaches out there. And Bars says, "You need a hockey program." Yost is from West Virginia and born in 1871, the son of a Confederate soldier. So this guy does not know a damn thing about hockey, rest assured. But he saw something in Bars that he must have liked. And Fielding Yost says, "Only if you're the first coach." And he gives him the full rein and the funding for it. So that is how the University of Michigan got hockey.
For the next 5 years, Bars shuttled between his med school classes and the hockey rink. He coached Michigan to 2 league titles. The team was popular, and that early success mattered. When the Great Depression hit, many schools in the Midwest dropped their hockey programs, but not Michigan. The Wolverines have since gone on to win 9 national championships, more than any other program in the country. Meanwhile, Boston and Halifax have stayed connected. Every year, Nova Scotia sends a 50-foot, 2-ton Christmas tree to Boston as thanks for the city's help after the explosion.
3, 2, 1!
As for Joseph Bars, After finishing medical school, he became the chief of surgery at a veterans hospital in Chicago, then opened his own practice. Oh, and one last thing. Joseph Bars, great-grandson of the guy who sank all those American ships, wound up marrying a woman from Battle Creek, Michigan. He became an American citizen.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For much more on the life of Joseph Bars and the events of December 6, 1917, check out John Bacon's book, The Great Halifax Explosion.